Hey, well, it's a take two, and thank you very much for being a Vanguardista. We appreciate it very much. Tell your friends. On the subject of tar.
Tell your friends.
Yeah. Well, do you think?
You know who's,
word of mouth.
You know
that's
who says
good.
That? Huey Morgan on BBC Six Music says, you'll like it. Tell your friends.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay, I didn't. And you, I believe, are partly responsible for Huey Morgan's broadcasting career. Because weren't you in the room when somebody... Because Huey Morgan was originally in the Fun Loving Criminals.
He was a bit... It's live on Five Live.
A bit sweary on Five Live.
And he came in with other members of his band and he just wouldn't stop swearing to the extent that I could see through the glass that they were thinking, we're going to have to pull this interview because, you know, you get away with one... naughty word, second one is problematic. And by the third one, you're thinking, okay, we're really in a serious situation. And nothing would stop him until the drummer from the band.
Oh, he's the drummer. I beg your pardon.
The drummer said, Huey, imagine your mum's in the room.
He said, when that light goes on.
Yeah, your mum's in the room.
And then he stopped. Got it.
So, but I think, you know, he's a smart guy. He knew what he was doing. But yes, that's right. And after that, he blossomed into the all-round broadcaster.
Yeah, I love that program. You'll like it. Tell your friends.
Just on the subject of Tar, which is where we were in take one, talking about Cate Blanchett, who presumably is going to be either getting the Oscar for best...
I would think so.
...female, do you think?
I would think so. Let me see what the odds checker odds is. Today is...
Well, we're speaking on the Wednesday the 18th.
Okay, so let me see whether she's still tippity-top. Here we go. Yep, so odds checker has Cate Blanchett as... I mean, it's a title fight between her and Michelle Yeoh, but Cate Blanchett has the edge as far as the bookies are concerned at the moment.
I had mentioned that I generally don't like films where the title is a made-up
It's the name of
character.
A fiction. So Vera Drake, not one of your faves.
Linton Granderson, fantastic name, says Schulte, Bernstein, Carrie-Anne, all great conductors, often known by just their last name, hence Tar, in the title. Dominique from Christchurch, New Zealand. Simon, how confused you must have been on numerous occasions over the years. After all, who the devil are Mary Poppins, Billy Elliot, Jack Reacher, Napoleon Dynamite, Sherlock Holmes, John Wick, Rocky, Forrest Gump, Dolores Claiborne, Ed Wood, Peter Pan, Francis Ha, Edward Scissorhands,
Pinocchio.
Barry Lyndon, Ben Hur, Jerry Maguire, Annie Hall, Donnie Brasco, Barton Fink, Jackie Brown, and Citizen Kane. I don't think you quite get away with that last one.
That's fantastic.
I mean, who are these people? Honestly, we need better titles.
I'm sorry, that is email of the week.
It's very good,
isn't it?
That's
fantastic.
DB on our YouTube channel, Tar is such an unrealistic movie. The truth is that it just didn't make sense in the detail. And the only crowd this film seems, in quotes, so real to are Twitter heads a few removes away from the world of ensemble music. You just can't be that kind of egomaniac and work with an ensemble, especially the Berlin one that famously has no conductor. Which I'm just going to pause at because I might be... Might have missed something here, DB, but I think they're referring to the fact that, although they don't say it, it's the Berlin Philharmonic is where she's the most famous Berlin orchestra, who elected Herbert von Karajan, elected Claudio Bardo, elected Sir Simon Rattle as their conductor. So they famously do have conductors, but it may well, that point might need clarification, and I accept that you may be more of an expert. But anyway, you can't work with an ensemble and be paid 10 times more than everyone else. Hold auditions and earn the respect of the group in such a way that they make you look good. Also, I thought the joke of the film is about how broken meritocracy is and how easy it is after a certain echelon to fail upwards. But apparently nobody, including the audience, is in on that joke. And I realise that the film isn't in on that joke either. For those amazed by Blanchett's performance, I suggest you watch The Aviator, Carol, Blue Jasmine and Notes on a Scandal, where she tests this deranged egomaniac character out a few times before finally unveiling Lydia Tár. All of those are better films, but not especially great ones. Well, I disagree with you on that, because I think she's fantastic and I think she is great, and it's not the same character.
No.
At all.
No, not, no.
And so therefore, DB, I believe you to be incorrect.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that.
So now we've had another email, thankfully a slightly shorter email, from Professor Elton.
Okay.
Dear Simon and Simone, I fear like the proverbial ghost at Christmas or the guest who outstays their welcome. No, Mark, I'm not looking at you. But I have an important...
But you kind of are, though, aren't you?
...public service update to my previous email. This is the gentleman who wrote an incredibly long email about Homer,
yes,
which then was too long to include even after being edited, so therefore sent down another shortened version, which was still incredibly long.
I would like to remind you of my favourite dictum, which is, I would have written less, but I didn't have time.
Correct. I was taking the usual scholarly style break over the holidays. I was reading an academic article on a topic from outside my field of specialism when my eyes alighted on a reference to the book The Iliad, or The Poem of Force, the author Simone Weil.
Okay.
Oh no. The dreadful realization dawned on me I had given you and the Vanguardistas erroneous information. In my email, I had attributed the Iliad or the Poem of Force to Hannah Arendt. Now, it's true that Arendt and Weil are often associated, not least because they're both Jewish political thinkers of the Second World War, and Arendt did write on Homer. But still, women have all too often been written out of intellectual history or indeed any kind of history. So for the record, Arendt discusses totalitarianism in The Human Condition, but it's Weil who dissects the operation of power in the Iliad or the Poem of Force. I am such an idiot. Let's start the new year as we mean to go on. Students, journalists, professors, check your references. Down with peddlers of post-truth politics. Signed, Professor Elton.
Can I?
And we have copies of his book here. Homer, Elton Barker and Joel Christensen, Beginner's Guide. So we can now take these home and test each other about our knowledge of Homer from now on.
Can I tell you
two? You can take it to Tromsø.
Tell you two things that are relevant to this. The first one is that there was a documentary recently that has a long section in it about something famously happening somewhere. And I'm just doing a no names, no pack drill. A colleague of mine said, yeah, it didn't happen there. And that whole 8-minute section of that documentary is completely wrong. Which would be one of those things that if you'd made the documentary, you just wouldn't want somebody to tell you because it would be like, damn. The other thing is my rule, and this is a rule that I live by, everything you know is wrong. And the reason I say that is because when you're fact-checking things, the things you don't fact-check are the things you know to be true. And that's always the things that trip you up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I live in a state of abject anxiety most of my life. About getting things wrong in letters or reviews or, you know, anything like that. The things that you get wrong are always the things you didn't check because you know they're right. And then you suddenly go,
I was wrong.
So I share the...
Professor Elton.
I share Professor Elton's... Did he say, you know, what a fool I am or what an idiot I am? Apparently the phrase that I use most commonly when talking to myself is, you idiot, Kermode.
Because he says, I am such an idiot.
Yeah, so precisely. So I feel that me and the professor are actually on a very similar, probably academic plane.
You think? Okay, that's very good. Oh, by the way, back on TAR, if you run an arts program on Radio 4.
Oh, here we go.
And you decide to invite someone who's an expert in classical music to come in and comment
on the film.
On the film. And specifically Cate Blanchett's performance as a conductor. Find someone who's actually seen the film. Just thought I'd mention that.
And also, if you are ever writing an article about a movie, if you say, I haven't seen the film, but that's it. I am not reading any further.
Correct. So here's something else. AI, which is... which we've been talking about for a
This is AI,
long
the
time.
Thing, not AI, artificial intelligence, the That's Steven Spielberg right. film.
I'm wondering whether to bring up AI, the film, with Steven Spielberg, just because it's now such a big topic that he must be thinking, I wonder if this...
We should have reissued the movie.
Now, I want to... Let's go back to the subject of AI.
Okay.
This is not the movie AI. This is...
AI, the actual thing.
The general thing, because it is a subject which is getting...
Which
an
is
awful
really,
lot of
really in everyone's
And I am
minds.
Wondering whether to bring up the subject of AI, the movie with Steven Spielberg, when I talked to him for the famous...
Oh, please do.
Because maybe it's worth looking
at. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Please
anyway,
do.
Lots of people have mentioned this, and you may well have read about it, but Lister Gerard Blair has alerted us to the views of Nick Cave on AI.
Okay.
This is in response to a fan.
Nick Cave from Nick Cave.
Famously Nick Cave.
Nick Cave from Warren Ellis, Nick Cave, right, fine.
In response to a fan who sent him a song in the style of Nick Cave. So asking the AI ChatGPT to do a song in the style of Nick Cave. Sent it to Nick Cave. Nick Cave says the following.
Okay.
I understand that ChatGPT is in its infancy, but perhaps that is the emerging horror of AI, that it will forever be in its infancy, that it always has further to go and the direction is always forward, always faster. It can never be rolled back or slowed down as it moves us towards a utopian future, maybe, or our total destruction. Who could possibly say
which?
I'm
going for the latter.
Judging by this song, quotes, in the style of Nick Cave, though, it doesn't look good. The apocalypse is well on its way. This song sucks. What ChatGPT is in this instance is replication as travesty. ChatGPT may be able to write a speech or an essay or a sermon or an obituary, but it cannot create a genuine song. It could perhaps, in time, create a song that is, on the surface, indistinguishable from an original, but it will always be a replication, a kind of burlesque.
Okay, that's a great phrase.
Now we get into real caveism stuff.
Okay, here we go.
What makes a great song is not its close resemblance to a recognisable work. Writing a good song is not mimicry or replication or pastiche. It is the opposite. It is an act of self-murder that destroys all one has strived to produce in the past. It is those dangerous, heart-stopping departures that catapult the artist beyond the limits of what he or she recognises as their known self. This is the part of the authentic creative struggle that precedes the invention of a unique lyric of actual value. It is the breathless confrontation with one's vulnerability, one's perilousness, one's smallness, pitted against a sense of sudden, shocking discovery. It is the redemptive artistic act that stirs the heart of the listener, where the listener recognises in the inner workings of the song their own blood, their own struggle, their own suffering. Thanks for sending me this song, but with all the love and respect in the world, it is a grotesque mockery of what it is to be human, and well, I don't much like it. Although, hang on, rereading it, there is a line in there that speaks to me. Quote, I've got the fire of hell in my eyes, says the song, in the style of Nick Cave, and that's kind of true. I have got the fire of hell in my eyes, and it's ChatGPT.
And love, that, ladies Nick. And gentlemen, is why Nick Cave is a legend.
I mean, that penultimate paragraph.
That's just.
My guess is,
you heard the song? Does it exist as a song? Is it just a written?
It's a written thing.
It's a lyric.
It's a lyric. But that paragraph, what makes a song great, ending in their own suffering. My guess is he sat there and he just wrote it.
Okay.
He didn't rewrite it. He didn't go back and make any changes. It just came like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, here's the interesting thing. So I'm quite pally with Warren Ellis, who is Nick Cave's musical partner. And in that documentary, you know, recently, there was that thing about Warren Ellis being described as an agent of chaos. And their working methods are very, very different. And Warren is, I mean, I think Warren is a genius. He's an absolute genius. But I remember being at Manchester University in the 80s and my friend Andy Hussey, who has subsequently gone on to be an incredibly well-respected academic, I think he might even be an OBE now, playing me records by the Birthday Party and going, this is the real deal. This is, there's all that goth stuff happening over there and it has nothing to do with the Birthday Party. This is the real. And I remember thinking, you know, having seen Nick Cave's extraordinary career and always remembering back to Andy Hussey in that, you know, upstairs bedroom in Fallowfield playing me these records and going, this is it. This is the thing. And thinking he was absolutely right. Nick Cave is, you know, he lives and breathes his art.
Yes. But that's, you know, the idea that AI certainly at the moment is replication, isn't it? That's what
it is. Yeah, that is what it is. And that was when we did the thing, I'm not comparing myself to Nick Cave, but when we did the, you know, give me a Mark Kermode review of something, it did a replication. It took a bunch of phrases that I might have used and strung them together in something approaching coherent English, which is more than I've ever managed to do.
The Masked Listener is back.
Oh, right. Okay, here we go.
Dear Mask of Zorro and Mask of Red Death, I was excited to hear you read my email last week where I raised the burning question, is the hardest working man in Hollywood and friend of the show, Jason Isaacs, going incognito as Phoenix on ITV's Masked Singer. Well, once again, I've watched The Masked Singer, so you don't have to. And following the Fiery Fowl's second appearance, I now feel I'm on very shaky ground. It could equally be any number of people, with the judges' guesses ranging from Mick Hucknall to Jason Statham.
Mick Hucknall!
A very broad spectrum indeed. Despite these creepy doubts, I'm not giving up just yet. I've done my best to link the program's notoriously obscure clues back to Jason somehow. I don't expect you to waste valuable podcasting minutes on this nonsense, but I record my efforts here for posterity in the still highly unlikely event I'm right. Clue, I'm mythical, independent, and magical. Well, mythical could just mean Jason, as in Jason and the Argonauts. Independent...
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Could allude to Jason's regular appearances on the jury for the British Independent
Film
Awards.
Yes, that's
magical
correct.
Could be, of course, a reference to Lucius Malfoy. So far, so promising. Here it gets trickier. Clue, a shot of two sticks of rock in the phrase out of this world. This could refer to Jason having been both guest and host of the European Space Agency's Space Rocks Conference held at the O2.
Also, he's in Armageddon.
Keep your eyes open. Jason starred in the TV thriller Awake back in 2013. Anyway, there's loads of these.
Okay.
As you can see, says the Master Listener, you'll need particularly large and flappy hands to successfully clutch at all of these straws. Maybe there's enough to keep the dream alive. Either way, I hope Phoenix is unmasked soon so I can give up Googling obscure Jason facts and move on with my life.
You can never give up Googling obscure Jason facts.
Or humiliation.
Wow.
Thank you, the Master
Listener.
Oops, sorry, bang the microphone.
Well, it's a genuine mystery. As Toya sang so evocatively.
John Penny says, Simon's reaction to Jason's cryptic text last week reminded me of the story about the legendary barrister F.E. Smith, later Lord Birkenhead. A judge once said to him, "Mr. Smith, I have listened to your submissions and frankly I am none the wiser." To which F.E. Smith replied, "Not wiser, my lord, but better informed." There you go. So that helps, I think. Here's something interesting. Barney Howes,
that's very good.
LTL and Burnham District
very
Junior
good.
Doubles Table Tennis Champion 2014. Dear Piranha and P. Ron Yar, in reference to your discussion on actors mispronouncing words in films, I recall as a child my dad had a pronounced dislike of Sean Bean, often intoning, "Oh God, not him," when he appeared on screen.
Why?
On questioning my dad about this seemingly irrational dislike of Yorkshire's finest, yeah, it transpired he held it against Sean Bean for not correcting Robert De Niro in the film Ronin on the on the accurate pronunciation of Hereford, like this.
"Car comes through here. Shooters across from each other, kill each other dead."
"Oh my, where'd you learn that? Huh?"
"In a regiment."
"What regiment was that?"
"The 22nd Special Air Service."
"What's the colour of the boathouse at Hereford? What's the colour of the boathouse at Hereford?"
"I don't like your attitude."
"The colour of the boathouse."
Well, I think they're going to say something.
They say what?
Rather rude there.
The fruit cake.
Hereford.
Hereford.
Hereford. As a child, I thought nothing of this, but now on reflection as a fully grown adult, I feel it somewhat churlish of my father
to hold it against the character.
Dear old Sean, for not correcting Robert De Niro on how to pronounce Hereford correctly.
So basically, in the scene, no, not in the scene, outside of the scene, Sean should have just said to Robert,
"It's Hereford." Robert, anyway, but Barney says, considering it may well have been a directorial decision to have Robert De Niro pronounce it that way,
wrong,
or, frankly, it was not Sean Bean's job to tell Robert De Niro
how to pronounce Hereford.
Although, actually, how to act, unless there was a specific plot point in saying Hereford instead of Hereford, it's a fair point to say to the English person on set, "How should we say this? It's Hereford." Mm. You've got that wrong.
Yeah. It is weird. I mean, actually, if you hadn't said Hereford, I wouldn't even have realised that that's what he was saying.
That maybe there was an American place that was named after Hereford, but they just called it Hereford because they're American.
Yeah, or maybe Sean Bean was just setting Robert De Niro up.
Maybe. Anyway, I think that's very interesting.
That's very good.
Correspondence at kerbinamayo.com. Time now for another round of pretentious moi.
Oh,
this is where I read out a paragraph from one of Mark's reviews, because he writes these reviews down in a Sunday newspaper.
Mm-hmm. It's called The Observer.
Oh, yes. And you have to guess the film.
I don't know why we're dancing around that fact. All those restrictions are off. It's called Observer. Simon's books are available in bookstores now. I have a band called the Dodge Brothers. You can download all their stuff on Spotify or buy their albums.
And you can go to North Norway and go to the Love Party.
To the Love Party, yeah, exactly.
Which is where Mark will be performing.
Yeah.
Although by the time you've heard this, he's already
I will have done
performed.
It.
Anyway, so Mark has to guess the film that he was actually writing about. The score is The People 8, Mark Kermode 6. Tension Bed, please. So it's a short quote.
Well, can you read it? Can you read it slowly to make it longer?
I've replaced someone's name with Lord Palmerston.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Here's the quote.
Okay, hang on.
The best thing in the... Mark takes his glasses off because it helps him think. The best thing in the movie is the short-lived appearance by Lord Palmerston as a snorting creep whom everyone hates, thus making him by far the most likable presence on screen. The quote again. Mm-hmm. The best thing in the movie is a short-lived appearance by Lord Palmerston as a snorting creep whom everyone hates, thus making him by far the most likable presence on screen.
Okay, so there's somebody in it who is playing a snorting creep in a cameo, and he's meant to be horrible, but everybody else likes him. Is that... Just read it once more.
The best thing in the movie is a short-lived appearance by Lord Palmerston as a snorting creep whom everyone hates, thus making him by far the most likable presence on screen. So you think this sounds like a Babylon kind of thing. You hate
this
everyone.
This is me saying I hate everyone in the film. Wow, that's difficult. I'm not going to get that. Can you give me...
Music's run out. We're out of time.
Okay, I'm going to take it as a no, but rather than telling me the answer,
yes.
Can you tell me the actor's name and see if... I accept that I haven't got this, but just to redeem some... Can you give me the actor's name and see whether I get there? Don't tell me the name of the film.
Okay. Michael, is it... Cera? Cera? C-E-R-A?
Michael Cera.
Michael Cera.
Oh! Oh,
Michael Cera.
Apocalypse movie. End of the world.
Almost. The best thing.
This is the end. This is the end. This is the end.
June 9th, 2013. This is the end. The best thing in the movie is shortly.
Okay, I didn't get it, but I got it with Michael Cera. I was okay. I'm sorry. That was very hard. Also, I didn't lead on that movie. I know for a fact that that's a roundup review. I didn't write a lead review on that. So, wow, because he's in the bathroom, isn't he? And then he loses his mobile phone, and then the thing happens. It's cool. Yeah, this is the okay. Fine. So what's that? That's 9-6, is it?
9-6. You'll pull it around. It's fine. I think you should spend the week rereading all of your past reviews. Just to get back online. Now, for One Frame Back, okay. the subject...
Damn! Botheration, sorry.
You're going to take that all the way up to Tromso and take it out on a double bass.
And it's not even my double bass that I'm going to take it out on.
In which case, that's fine.
I am going to take it out. Out upon which I am going to take it.
No, you've had editors telling you that doesn't matter anymore.
Okay.
One Frame Back, films featuring actors who make the transition from silent era to talkies. I did suggest debauchery. Clearly, debauched films, I think, would have been more interesting. That was all redacted.
Was it? Okay.
Yes. Justin Shepherd, anything with Conrad Veidt in it. Heather Wallace, interestingly, most of the UK actors and those Americans who started on the stage are fine, probably because they either had an acceptable accent or could sing and dance and fight. Joan Crawford, Laurel and Hardy, Gloria Swanson being a notable failure in transitioning. Super Claude says, Ronald Coleman, to be sure. Very handsome fellow, turned out to have a voice as sure and as dapper as himself. Joe Smith, Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, not only the last Tramp film, but also the first time you hear his voice on film, even though the words he sings are deliberately gibberish.
Yeah.
Barry Duff, William Powell, Libeled Lady, 1936, My Man Godfrey, 1936, The Thin Man, 1934. And Rockin' Chimp says Marlena Dietrich in the likes of Dishonored and The Devil is a Woman. What are you going to go for there making that successful transition?
I mean, the Chaplin thing is kind of interesting because Chaplin straddles so much cinema, and yet there was all the stuff about the Tramp not talking, and then of course you get Mischief.
Dietrich. I think I will go for Chaplin. Largely because if I don't, Mike Hammond will smack me about the head with his guitar when we're in Tromso.
And he's in the Dodge Brothers.
He's in the Dodge Brothers, and he's an absolute, you know, Chaplin aficionado. What he was the person who, when they found a bit of film that they thought was a lost Chaplin film, they got in touch with him and said, "Is it?" And he went, "Actually, no. It's not. It's because there was loads of Chaplin impersonators and all the rest of it. So yeah, he knows Chaplin inside out. And I think he would strike me about the head with an effects box if I didn't say Chaplin.
I haven't seen Modern Times for a long time. Does Charlie Chaplin act drunk in Modern Times? Is there a sequence?
He acts drunk in several. There are several drunken tramp sequences.
Okay, maybe it's another. Anyway, I remember when I was a very small child reading books about magic, and they said,
"Oh, that's interesting."
That if you wanted to, there was a sequence which involved drinking beer, and so on. They said, "Watch a Charlie Chaplin. Watch Charlie Chaplin being drunk, because that's what you need to do if you're going to play this. If you're going to do this trick." Anyway,
I mean, yes, he was, because a lot of that kind of music hall training, it's pantomiming and what we now refer to as clowning, you know, the drunken acting is a very, very hard thing to get right. Particularly physical drunken acting is a hard thing to get right. There's a lovely moment in E.T. when E.T. gets drunk and walks into the, you know, into the thing, and the young man who's acting E.T. in that, because he's got the E.T. costume and he's walking on his hands. And it's a really physically brilliant thing. And I was reading a piece about it in something that I've been reading recently, about how partly it was to do with the fact that the costume was so clumsy and so difficult to walk in that it was that was kind of what inspired the sequence. That it was, you know, the thing about when somebody's drunk, it looks like they're wearing flesh that isn't quite theirs, and they're quite disorganized. So there is a brilliant bit of drunken E.T., like walking into the fridge door and all that stuff in E.T., which I think is lovely. I would also cite, incidentally, on a similar thing, you know, the drones in Silent Running, that again, those are actors walking on their hands. And the physical acting in E.T. is amazing. In Silent Running is amazing.
Next week, it's the release of The Fablemans. So that means Steven Spielberg conversation will be coming up very soon.
Give me my best.
I will. We'd like to hear your suggestions for autobiographical films by directors.
Yes.
Also, correspondence at Conan Mayo.com or find us on our social channels. Also, if you've got questions, because I think we're going to have enough time to do listeners' questions to Steven Spielberg. So you don't get that opportunity very often.
You don't.
So correspondence@kermitandmayo.com for next week when we're going to be talking about The Fablemans. Now, this week's You Decide is Copenhagen Cowboy.
I have a bonus review. Are we going to do that before You Decide? We usually do.
Let's do that then. Should we do that?
If that's all right, I mean...
That's fine. Let's
I mean,
say,
far be it from me or anything,
No. Okay. We're going to get to Copenhagen Cowboy very, very shortly. Yeah.
I mean, I just mentioned this because I did bother to watch the film.
As
so
Mark
I think
correctly interjects at this point, there's something else to go and see. Tell us all about this film.
The Substitute, international co-production set in Buenos Aires and directed by Argentine filmmaker Diego Lerman. Juan Minujín, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, is Lucio, who's a sometime writer, now a part-time teacher, who we see starting his substitute job. He's a stand-in teacher, the substitute of the title, in a school in the suburbs of Buenos Aires. The kids aren't interested. They've got lives of their own. They have no interest in literature. Some of them are on their phones. One of them is asleep because he works in the factories at night. And so he sleeps in the day during the literature lessons. And during one of the lessons, trying to get them to discuss poetry, he discovers that one of them has a talent for rapping. He discovers that another lost a brother was killed. And he starts to discover stuff about the lives of the kids whilst also attempting to engage with them and get them engaged in literature. Meanwhile, the police bust the school looking for drugs and take away one of his pupils. Here is a clip from The Substitute.
Tu nombre? Dylan. ¿Para qué pensas que sirve la literatura?
Para nada.
Ahora decirle un poquito más fuerte a ver si se despierta ahí el amigo de atrás.
Que la literatura no sirve para nada.
Casi. Bueno, acá el compañero dice que la literatura no sirve para nada y creo que tiene razón, coincido. La literatura en realidad no nos sirve para nada, no tiene ninguna utilidad, no es un bien, no podemos comer, no podemos respirar, no podemos comprar nada con la literatura. ¿No? En términos prácticos, es completamente prescindible.
Entonces, ¿para qué venís? ¿Qué haces acá?
It's funny, I'm reminded watching that, and in that clip, basically, it's a discussion about, you know, what do you think of literature? I think it's useless. I think he said, well, the teacher says, well, it is useless, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't do anything for us. You can't, you know, it doesn't make anything. You can't eat it. You can't live on it.
So the people at the end says, so why are you here? That's why they all go, ooh.
Exactly. And I was reminded during that scene of, there's a bit, and I think it's Breakfast of Champions, the Kurt Vonnegut book. I'm a huge Kurt Vonnegut fan, in which he talks about, you know, a young school kid saying, why do I want to read Tale of Two Cities? What's the point? And Vonnegut says he was absolutely right. Art had totally failed them. And then there's a kind of discussion beyond that about, well, art is, by its inherent nature, useless in inverted commas, which I think is how members of the government see it. But actually, but I think actually it is also absolutely essential, as people were saying, if you think art is useless, try getting through lockdown without reading a book or watching a television program, and tell us, you know, about that. The thing with this is the setup itself is kind of as old as the hills. I mean, you think about movies from Blackboard Jungle to Casablanca Beats just recently, just last year, wasn't it? Via To Sir With Love, and I mean, Dangerous Minds came out when you and I were together at Radio 1. I was just saying the other day how embarrassed I was to discover only after hearing Gangster's Paradise many, many times, not realizing that it was a Stevie Wonder song, Pastime Paradise, and then going, are they allowed to do that?
From Songs in the Key
of Life. The difference is that what this does is it really gets into the complexity of the situation. Nothing is clear-cut. Nothing is trite. The teacher has a father who is very revered locally and who is ill. There is also a local drug lord who is moving in, who is circling this situation, which the teacher has suddenly found himself in. His father is saying, you have to take over my business. At times I was put in, and I mean this as a real compliment, I was put in mind of series 4 of The Wire, in which that microcosm, that classroom microcosm, is, you know, sort of indicative of the wider world, and into which comes a character from that outside world who then is suddenly confronted with, this is where everything is really playing out in this very sort of, you know, obvious arena. You do believe in the kids, you do believe in the teacher, not least because, as with a film like Half Nelson, he is flawed, he is troubled, he is by no means, you know, perfect in any way. So actually I found it very engrossing, very moving, and although it's telling a story which has been told before in different ways, I thought it was doing it very convincingly. It's called The Substitute.
General release, or will that be quite a difficult one?
I think
one
you'll
find?
Have to seek it out, but it's worth, you know, if you're interested in, as I said, if you're interested in that thread of movies that I was just talking about, I think you will find much to enjoy in this.
This week's You Decide, Take It or Leave It, etc.
And you could watch it at least twice during the course of Babylon.
Yes,
sorry.
Which you'd be better off.
Yeah.
Copenhagen Cowboy. Now, Irish Mark in Zurich says, dear Mayonnaise and Ketchup, I recently watched Nicholas Winding Refn's new Netflix show, Copenhagen Cowboy. It starts slowly and builds. It's super stylish and very influenced by David Lynch and Andrei Tarkovsky. I'd love to hear your takes on it, from Irish Mark in Zurich.
Okay, so
Copenhagen Cowboy.
Copenhagen Cowboy, or as I should be pronouncing it,
Copenhagen.
Copenhagen Cowboy. So noir thriller TV series from, it says at the beginning, from NWR, Nick Winding Refn, on Netflix. His first Danish language work since Pusher 3, although on Netflix there is a dubbed version as well. The sort of one-line synopsis says, a renegade goes on a quest for vengeance while navigating her way through Copenhagen's criminal underworld.
Just say Copenhagen.
Copenhagen, it's easier, isn't it? Premiered in Venice in September. So I've watched two episodes. The first one's about an hour, second one's slightly shorter. First one opens and closes with a woman in stilettos being strangled in a pig farm. In between, we're introduced to Mew the Mysterious, a young woman played by Angela Bundelovich, who appears to have been purchased as a lucky charm by a woman who runs a brothel. And there's an early scene of her hair being cut and fragments of the hair being passed around, and you know, as sort of lucky charms. Meanwhile, in the brothel, women lounge around in states of undress, being variously abused by various unsavory characters. One of them attempts to get away, which brings us back to that pig farm beginning and ending and something very nasty. And then episode two, Vengeance Is My Name, sees the start of the sort of the main thread. Now, here's my thoughts of this are this. I'm 2 hours in, so I've given it the length of a feature film. It was interesting that the emailer said very influenced by David Lynch, in as much as huge sections of it desperately want you to think that you're watching the Red Room stuff from Twin Peaks. I think, and I'm a fan of Nick Winding Refn. I mean, I like Neon Demon, and I really, really like Drive. And I remember reviewing the Pusher movies again back in the days of Radio One, and I met him a couple of times, and very nice guy, and all the rest of it. I think this is absolutely style over substance. Lots and lots of glamorously arrayed women, lots of shots drenched in red and blue lights, lots of gnomic unclarity, and lots of the camera panning slowly, slowly round the room, slowly, going all the way around and then coming back to where we started again in a manner that just makes me think, oh, come on, this is starting to annoy me. Imagine the Neon Demon without the substance. And incidentally, I speak as somebody who liked the Neon Demon despite the fact that it was pretty low on substance and very, very high on style. It did feel to me like an indulgence. By the end of the second episode, unless somebody writes in and convinces me, immediately going to have an uphill struggle, I've watched 2 hours, I don't care. I'm not interested in what happens. I honestly cannot be asked to go back to watch a third hour of it because I feel like I've given it 2 hours of my time and it may be a slow start and a longer build-up, but I kind of figure like after 2 hours, you really should have got your hooks into me.
I think so.
And it hasn't. Also, interesting to note, and I looked this up afterwards, there was a stink that PETA, the animal rights monitoring thing, filed a complaint accusing Copenhagen Cowboy of killing pigs during the filming process. It was revealed that a farmer that had supplied the pigs for the series in turn witnessed a pig being shot and killed specifically for a scene. It was confirmed by the Copenhagens. Anyway, I read that and it was like, okay, that's another reason to not go back, to be honest.
Okay, well, that shouldn't be allowed, should it? You can't.
I don't think that's in the. But that scene is taken from the. I don't think it's in the. It's not. It's there, but it's just. It's a lot of stylish hooey, and the thing is, like, underneath this jumper, I'm wearing a Twin Peaks T-shirt, which Child 2 bought for me because I love Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks was never style over substance, and a lot of substance and a lot of style. But this just felt like, I don't care.
Your suggestion for, in your opinion, great streaming stuff that we might have missed. I am going to suggest that we do The Last of Us.
Oh, yes, please, because it just started.
It has just started, and it's getting a lot of serious reviews.
Can I ask, have you played the computer game?
No, of course not.
No, but I'm just, neither have I.
But Child One, who has.
Yes, and I'm in the similar circumstance.
Is loving it. I've watched episode one. I quite like to carry on watching this because it's got
you've seen episode one already.
Yeah, okay. So but it's got to work as a TV, you know, for people who haven't watched and haven't played the game.
Which we haven't.
They need to just enjoy the show. So I think it looks fantastic, actually. So shall we do that next week?
That works for me.
Yeah, I don't think they're listening. So we could just say anything at all. I mean, that was a kind of a disinterested,
Can't
say anything. Okay, so let's do The Last of Us, which is on.
So we'll do the. So by next week, we will have watched the first two episodes of The Last of Us.
Okay, and if you have played the game and seen the show or have anything to say on The Last of Us, correspondence@kermanandmayo.com.
Let's just say on this sheet, this thing that passes for a script, that program is called The Copenhagen Cowboy.
Yeah, well, it's three words there. Nicely done. So, correspondence coming to mail.com. If you played the game, if you've seen the show, join the conversation next week for The Last of Us.
I'm still cross about this is the end.
Well, I'm afraid that point is gone. No point in crying over spilt milk. There you go. We'll be back with another take before you can say...
Before you can say
Before you can say Tim. Tim Sherwood. Let's say that. Before you can say Tim
Sherwood. I never understood who's Tim Sherwood.
It's a football reference. It doesn't matter.
Fine.